Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, November 10th. And we're going to take a look at the schedule real quick after I turn the lights down a little bit. All right, now we're going to look at the schedule. That's probably really important to do. There. Nice. Okay, so the schedule. Schedules right here. All right, so we said today is the 10th. And we're going to finish up chapter 13, blood, heart, circulation today. And that means next time on Thursday, the 12th, exam 3 on 4 chapters. All right, 10, 11, 12, and 13. And then we have, after that test, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 lectures. And then we're going to get the last exam on December 10th, and that's over 4 chapters as well. Okay, so that's the deal with everything. So don't forget, next time, picture ID, please. Scantron, 882E, maybe ES. Pencil, really good eraser. I don't think you need a calculator for this exam, but you could bring it along anyway if you want to. All right, so anybody have a question on the schedule? We're okay with that? All right, anybody have a question over what we talked about last time? No questions. Okay, well, that means I have some questions for you. How many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves does the heart have? How many sides does the heart have? And how many circulations does the heart have?
Two.
What are the names of the circulations? Pulmonary and systemic, right? So that's all just kind of anatomy, so hopefully that rings a bell. What isn't anatomy that we talked about last time, and that is the amount of blood flowing through the systemic circulation and the pulmonary circulation, right? If you're going to compare those two, which one has more blood flow going through it? The systemic or the pulmonary? Okay, and that is kind of a trick question because the blood flow has got to be the same between the pulmonary and systemic, because if it's not, then blood is going to back up someplace. So maybe what you were thinking about is the blood pressure. And the blood pressure indeed is lower for pulmonary circulation than it is for systemic circulation, because the pulmonary circulation is very short, has very little resistance. Right? Systemic circulation is long, has a lot of resistance, it takes more pressure to have blood flow through that higher resistance circuit. Right? And since the left side of the heart has to work stronger by producing more pressure, what can you tell me about the thickness of the muscle of the left ventricle compared to the right ventricle? The left ventricle is what, thicker or thinner than the right? It's got to be thicker and stronger, right? And when I look at these curves that I'm showing right here, this is a Wiggers diagram. This is sort of where we left off last time. Right? I see graphs of pressure versus time. Pressure in the ventricle, pressure in the aorta, pressure in the left atria. And then I see volume, and then I see electrocardiogram, and then I see a sonogram or phonocardiogram, some sounds that the heart makes. Right? But if we look at pressure, I see pressure in the ventricle going from 0 all the way up to 120, right? And that's kind of a dead giveaway as to being whether that's the pulmonary circulation or systemic circulation. All right, so remember that when you get your blood pressure measured, you get two numbers. You get the systolic pressure, which is the peak pressure, and you get the diastolic, which is the lowest pressure in the systemic arteries. Right? And it never goes to zero. There's always some blood pressure left in systemic arteries, even though the pressure in the ventricle goes from 0 to 120 and then back to 0. All right, so when I see 0 to 120, that's a large pressure difference. So that is the left ventricle. That's systemic circulation. Right? And when you get your blood pressure measured, it is of the systemic circulation, not the pulmonary circulation. There's some previous slides that tell you what the pulmonary circulation pressure is. It's a lot less. Maybe not even 30 over 10. Maybe 28 over 7, something like that, as opposed to 120 over 80. And what does that 80 refer to? Diastolic pressure, right? 120 refers to systolic pressure. Nice. All right, let's look at this volume curve. All right, so I see the volume of the left ventricle increasing until all of a sudden it starts to contract. And then what happens to the volume of the ventricle when it's contracting? It goes back down, right, during the ejection phase, and then it fills back up once again. Right, there are two important volumes of the ventricle that we're interested in. Right, one is end diastolic volume, the other is end systolic volume. And this one, they're going to be either a maximum or minimum. So here is one. This is the maximum of the volume curve. The maximum is what? End diastolic or end systolic volume. And you could probably read it off of this graph right here. Okay, so right here, where is that happening? It is right at the end of diastole, right at the beginning of systole, right? So here is the end diastolic volume. So is end diastolic volume the largest volume or the smallest volume of the ventricle? It's the largest when you look at this graph, and that makes perfect sense because during diastole, that's when the ventricle fills with blood. And when it's filling with blood, then the volume expands, right? And then after contraction, here I see contraction, the pressure goes way up, blood is ejected from the heart, so the volume goes down because this volume of blood ends up in the aorta. This lowest value right here is the end systolic volume, right? So end systole, at the end of when the heart is contracting, that's when the volume inside the ventricle is the smallest. And even more importantly is to know something about the stroke volume of the heart. And on this graph, you would be able to calculate what the stroke volume is. How would you calculate stroke volume? You subtract the two and just make sure you don't end up with a negative number, right? So take the largest number, which is end diastolic volume, subtract the smaller number, end systolic volume, and that gives you how much blood was actually pumped out of the heart. Okay, so there's pressure and volume considerations right here. This graph, the one in your textbook, one in your lab manual is pretty good. The Wiggers diagram in your manual, lab manual is pretty good. This one's not bad, but there is an error here that I think you want to know about. How does a fluid flow? It could be a gas or it could be liquid, okay? And there has to be something to make it move around. Without that something, it's not going to move around. It's just going to sit still. You could think of diffusion. What makes diffusion work? Concentration gradient, right? So it's a similar kind of thing, but it's not concentration for fluids. It is something called, we got it right here, it is pressure. Right, so a fluid will flow, just like diffusion, from high pressure to low pressure. That's how a fluid will flow, just naturally. All right, and remember, valves prevent retrograde flow of blood, like flow of blood from the aorta back into the ventricle. Valves are going to prevent that from happening. That would be what, the aortic semilunar valve? Okay. All right, so let's take a look at this pressure curve for the ventricle. We see that in this region right here, the pressure in the ventricle, right, and even over here, the pressure in the ventricle is a lot less, okay, well, is less than the, this is going to be the bicuspid valve. All right, so here is pressure in the atria, here is pressure in the ventricle. Which way is blood going to flow if there's higher pressure in the atrium? It's going to go from high pressure to low, so blood will flow from the atrium into a ventricle, and what's going to happen to the volume then of the ventricle? It's going to increase, right? Okay. So, right, the pressure in this region right here of the ventricle is less than the aorta. So will blood want to flow from a ventricle into the aorta if this pressure is almost zero inside a ventricle? No, it will want to go back from the aorta into the ventricle, but there's something that prevents that from happening. What is that? That is the aortic semilunar valve. Okay? All right. Now the pressure in the ventricle starts to skyrocket because the ventricle is contracting. And then in this region right here, we see pressure in the ventricle greater than the aorta. Which way is blood going to want to go? Pressure in the ventricle high, pressure in the aorta low. Which way should blood want to go? From the ventricle into the aorta, and can it do that? And the answer is yes, because the aortic semilunar valve opens up to allow blood to flow into the aorta. So that's why right here it says aortic valve opens up, because that's when the pressure in the ventricle is greater than the aorta, right? And that ejects blood. All right, now here's where the curve is a little bit misleading. Right at this point right here, what can you tell me about the pressure in the aorta and pressure in the ventricle right at this location right here? They're exactly the same. Nice. Let me get my cursor. I couldn't do this yesterday for some reason. Thank goodness I can do it today. All right, so right here. So now we have high pressure in the aorta, low in the ventricle. Which way will blood want to go? From high to low, right? So from aorta into ventricle, but can it do that? No, because the semilunar valve closes. Well, see, right here is where they have the semilunar valve closing, but where should it be on this diagram? It should be right here, okay? The figure in your lab manual shows that properly, right? The crossover points. All right, so only one, this blue line, is higher than, I don't know, whatever color line that is, maybe red. Okay, does blood flow from the ventricle into the aorta? When, and blood in the aorta can't flow into the ventricle because the aortic semilunar valve closes, right? And that produces what? The second heart sound. The first heart sound is produced when the AV valve closes. When pressure in the ventricle exceeds that of the atria, right, that atrioventricular valve closes, and on the left side of the heart, that would be the bicuspid or mitral valve, right? And it slams closed, and that makes this heart sound over here. All right, so that's kind of the Wiggers diagram. Make sure you can see where end diastolic volume is, end systolic volume, what stroke volume is all about. Okay, so let's go on to the next slide, unless somebody has a question about that. Okay, heart sounds we just talked about. The heart can make abnormal sounds. We call these murmurs. Murmurs can be due to a number of different things, and a lot of the times it's due to misbehavior of a valve. Maybe a valve doesn't open up all the way, or maybe a valve doesn't close all the way. In either case, that's going to be an insufficient valve or an incompetent valve, and you're going to get squeaking sounds like when you let air out of a balloon, right? You can get a squeaking sound. And there shouldn't have any squeaking sounds. Some of these are congenital in origin. Maybe you're born with a birth defect, and sometimes they're developmental, which means that it happens over your lifetime. And a lot of times we don't exactly know, but we think it's due to some viral infection, and it might be the virus that attacks the valve, or it might even be the person's own immune system that is attacking the virus, and there's some cross-reaction between antibodies that are killing the virus and a person's heart. Okay. And as a matter of fact, here is a really good example of that. Dental caries or cavities in teeth are produced by bacterial action. Bacteria that live on the surface of your teeth, when they digest sugars, they produce acids, and those acids will etch our teeth away and produce a cavity. So cavities are produced by these bacteria. So somebody had a really good idea. This is a fantastic idea. What can we give somebody to prevent them from getting sick due to a bacteria or maybe even a virus? You can give them antibiotic if they're infected, but here's a way that they won't even become infected. You can give them immunization shots, right? You can give them a vaccine. So somebody had a fantastic idea. Let's give a vaccine, right, to Streptococcus mutans and Lactobacilli. And if we have a vaccine, then we wipe out these bacteria and there won't be anything as dental cavities anymore, or dental caries. So that's fantastic. So they did some experiments, fortunately, in some animal models, and they realized that indeed their experimental animals would never get dental caries, but the antibodies that are produced by that vaccine attack the heart of that host organism. So not only did that organism, were they protected from dental caries by the vaccine, but it also killed their heart. So we can't do that with people until somebody figures out a better method, right? Because what would you rather have, dental caries or no heart? I'd rather have cavities, right? Okay. All right, so there can be cross-reaction. So heart murmurs can be due to valves that don't open or close. Here's stenosis, is when a valve doesn't open properly. Maybe there are some plaques, calcium plaques or cholesterol plaques on a valve, and sometimes they don't close properly. Right? In either case, they're called incompetent or insufficient valves. Right? And you know all the valves of the heart. Another reason why you might have a heart murmur is that there might be a hole between two chambers of the heart, like a hole between the right atrium and left atrium. In the fetal circulation, there is a proper hole, right? It's called the foramen ovale, because then that just allows the fetal circulation to bypass the lungs, and when there's a fetus, there's no reason to have a lot of blood going to the lungs because there's no oxygen in the lungs anyway because they're not breathing. So blood will pass from the right atrium into the left atrium, and that saves a lot of work of the fetal heart. So they're healthier that way. If that hole doesn't close when you're born, that's called a patent foramen ovale. And remember, a foramen is a hole in something. And patent just means that it is open. If you have a blood vessel that's patent, it means it's open and blood can flow through it. All right? If it's not patent, then there's a blockage someplace. So a PFO, right, is not supposed to be there in the adult. So that's a lot of times that can be really dangerous, but it might take years and years and years before somebody goes into cardiac failure. Somebody might be 30 years old before that happens, and then they do a diagnostic test and they say, oh, well, you have this hole in your heart right here. We need to close that off. And it used to be open heart surgery, but now they can thread instruments into the inferior vena cava via your leg and actually sew closed without doing a thoracotomy or opening somebody's chest. So instead of being in the hospital for 2 or 3 weeks, they probably almost make you go home the next day, which is probably okay. All right, so here is that PFO in the interatrial septum. You can have a hole, right, in the interventricular septum. And remember, these are the high-pressure chambers. And which one is going to be a higher pressure, the right ventricle or left ventricle? The left ventricle is always going to be higher than the right. So if there's a hole right here, which way is blood going to squirt? From right to left or left to right, or is it going to go back and forth, interchange? It's always going to go from the left ventricle into the right ventricle because there's always higher pressure in the left ventricle, right? And blood is going to squeak through here, and that's a very dangerous situation. So this is a septal defect, and it's going to make a sound. All right, so why does blood always flow or squirt from the left into the right ventricle? Because the left ventricle is pumping blood into the systemic circulation, and in order to make it through the systemic circulation, you need high pressure to do that. All right, so those are some murmurs within the heart. Could be due to valves or holes in the septa. Electrical activity of the heart. Well, muscle tissue is a lot like nervous tissue because there are voltage-gated channels in muscles, right? And so muscles can transmit what? If there's a voltage-gated channel, what does that allow that cell to do? Transmit and action potential. Yeah, action potential. All right, so there are two different kinds of cells in the heart. There are nodal cells and contractile cells. They have a little bit different electrical properties, which we're going to look at in just a second. And I want to look over the nodal tissues right now. So the SA node, AV node, bundle branches, right? Purkinje fibers, these are muscle cells, but they don't contract. They carry action potentials. That's their primary job. Right, so even though they're muscle cells, they're not responsible for contraction. They're responsible for transmitting action potentials throughout the heart. And what do you know about an action potential? Yeah, it's not always excitatory, okay? But in this particular case, it's an excitatory event, right? All right, so the heart contracts as a unit, and that's because cardiac muscle has intercalated discs. Intercalated discs have gap junctions. And so there are electrical synapses between the myocardial cells. So if sodium all of a sudden rushes into one myocardial cell, right? What happens to that one cell when sodium rushes in? Depolarizes. That's an excitatory event. When sodium levels increase in one cell, what happens if there's a way to get into a neighboring cell? Guess what happens to that sodium? Diffuses into the neighboring cell through that gap junction. And then what kind of event happens in the neighboring cell? It depolarizes, and so that's another excitatory event. All right, so these action potentials can travel through the whole heart. Here is the SA node, otherwise known as the pacemaker of the heart. This one spontaneously depolarizes and depolarizes to threshold. An action potential ensues, and then that action potential travels over both atria first, right, and then down to this AV node into the atrioventricular bundle or bundle of His, and then down the septum through the bundle branches till it gets down to the apex of the heart, and that electrical signal then is distributed by these Purkinje fibers, then causing the both ventricles to contract. So when you think of electrical events on the heart, SA node starts it out, that's the pacemaker, right? Then you have action potentials all over the atria, so the atria contract first. Depolarization of atria is not exactly the same as contraction, but depolarization is a signal for contraction. There's a little bit of time delay. Right, then that action potential reaches the AV node. It's delayed in the AV node, and then eventually makes its way down to the AV bundle. Right, so the both atria contract, then the signal goes down to the apex, and the apex starts to contract first, and then the more basilar regions of the heart contract, right? And that's due to that action potential coming down. So both atria contract together first, followed by both ventricles. So you don't have one ventricle contracting and then the other, right? Usually we like to think as the heart beating, the whole thing is one contraction, but actually the atria contract a little bit before the ventricles do. Right, so there's a fibrous skeleton between the atria and the ventricles. That fibrous skeleton is connective tissue. That connective tissue doesn't have voltage-gated channels. So can that action potential easily move from an atria into a ventricle if that fibrous skeleton doesn't have voltage-gated channels? It cannot, right? So that signal is blocked. The only way for that action potential to get into the ventricles is via the AV node and AV bundle and then down into the ventricle. If somebody has a heart attack in this region right here, right, then the atria cannot control the ventricles. That signal cannot get into the ventricles. So the atria will contract with one rhythm and another pacemaker will develop in the ventricles, and then that will drive the ventricles at a different heart rate. And that's usually not such a big problem. Because the atria, okay, look at the thickness of the wall. Does it look like the atria are really strong and pump a lot of blood? Really thin muscles. They hardly pump blood at all. Right, so if there's no really good coordination between the atria and ventricles, that's really not too serious an event. So when the ventricles contract, okay, when the ventricles contract, they are really forceful. They go boom, boom, and they bounce up against your thorax wall, that point of maximal impulse that you can palpate, right? So the ventricles are very rigorous. When an atria contracts, it kind of goes like this. Did you even see my hands move? Just a little bit, okay? All right, so the atria are not so important. They just add a little bit of volume to the ventricle before it contracts, but not very much. All right, so that's the conduction system due to nodal cells, which are modified muscle cells that don't contract, but they have special kinds of channels in them to allow for that action potential to reach down all the way to the apex. Apex contracts first, followed by the basal regions, and that's pretty important because where are the great vessels? Where are the great arteries on the heart? Are they down here by the apex or up here by the base? Like the aorta is a great vessel, the pulmonary artery is a great vessel. So if the basal regions contracted first, that would force blood down into the apex, and where could it go? Nowhere. So the apex contracts a little bit first, forces blood up to the base, and then out the great arteries, right? So that's why the conduction system is there the way it is. Okay, I see an action potential here, right? And here is another action potential right here, right? These are from different kinds of cells in the heart. And remember, there are two kinds. There's nodal cells and contractile cells. They have a little bit different action potential. What we're looking at right here are nodal cells, right? Your book calls them conductive cells. They don't contract, but they transmit action potentials, right? And, for instance, the sinoatrial node is made up of cells that behave like this. All right, so let's take a look. Where's resting membrane potential? Maybe minus 55, something like that. Okay? And what happens at that point? Is the cell ever at rest? It starts to immediately do what? Depolarize, right? And that's due to some special sodium channels that are in the cell membranes of these cells. We call them HCN channels, right? So they're leaky sodium channels. And what happens when sodium leaks into one of these nodal cells? It causes depolarization, right? So that causes this slow depolarization. And when it reaches threshold, right, then you have a rapid depolarization, not due to sodium channels, but to calcium channels, voltage-gated calcium channels. That causes the action potential. Repolarization takes place the usual way with potassium channels. Gets back down to RMP, but remember those HCN channels open up again and they start to leak sodium and it starts to depolarize. So this happens without innervation, without any kind of nervous input. These cells are autorhythmic because of these HCN channels. They just automatically depolarize. And depending on the slope of this depolarization right here before it reaches threshold will determine what the heart rate is. All right, so if the slope is really shallow, then it's going to take a much longer time to reach threshold. And what's going to happen to heart rate if it takes longer to get to threshold? Heart rate is going to decrease, right? If this slope becomes greater, like this, right? Maybe more HCN channels open up, then the heart rate is going to increase. It all depends on the slope of this pacemaker potential. All right, so the rapid depolarization in nodal tissue is due to calcium channels. All right, other tissues in the heart can be spontaneously active, like when there's a blockage between the atria and ventricles. There is another pacemaker that develops in the ventricle, which will then control the rate of the ventricle contraction. Okay. The other cells, the contractile cells, have a resting membrane potential a lot more, about minus 90 millivolts. Right? And they depolarize the threshold by action potential starting at the sinoatrial node. What's another name for sinoatrial node? Pacemaker of the heart, right? Okay, so usually the SA node controls the heart rate under normal conditions. This is what an action potential looks like for a contractile cell, one that actually contracts. All right, so when a nodal cell depolarizes, that will trigger this rapid depolarization of a contractile cell, and that's just the usual sodium rushing inside the cell. All right, so that's just a voltage-gated sodium channel that opens up. Positive feedback, right, as it starts to depolarize, more sodium channels open up, which causes more depolarization, which causes more sodium channels to open up. So here is that rapid depolarization. And you're familiar with that with a typical kind of action potential that you're familiar with from nerves. All right, so that is depolarization. You should be able to tell me sodium going in is depolarization. All right, now let's look at repolarization. You see anything different happening here? It is extended. There is a plateau phase. These contractile cells don't repolarize immediately like we would expect with a little bit of overshoot right here. We have this plateau phase due to calcium channels that have opened up. But these are only the contractile cells, not the nodal cells. Where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. When these calcium channels open up, then what happens to membrane potential? Yeah, it depolarizes. So these calcium channels maintain the state of depolarization. Right? And as the state of depolarization is maintained by these calcium channels, the inactivation gate for these sodium channels doesn't get reset. So the inactivation gate on these voltage-gated sodium channels remain closed. Right? So what does that mean? The refractory period for contractile cells of the heart is long. Right, so, and since there's a refractory period that's long, that means that heart muscle can't go into tetany, which is wonderful. You can't get a cramp in your heart like you can with skeletal muscle, right? Because this myocardial cell can't be triggered into contracting until it is repolarized back down to RMP. So this calcium channel prevents tetany from occurring in contractile cells of the heart. We call this a plateau phase. And then this usual repolarization takes place with potassium leaving the cell. All right, so you see a really big difference between the nodal cells in terms of its action potential and the contractile cells. The beautiful thing about contractile cells is this plateau phase, right, which extends the refractory period. So that muscle, that cardiac muscle cell, cannot contract again, right? Okay. This also shows you that depolarization happens first, repolarization happens at a much later time because of this plateau phase. That's going to make some sense in just a little bit. Okay. Conducting system of the heart, you know, I think we've talked about that already. The job of the atrial ventricular node right here is to delay the signal entering the ventricles. That ensures that both atria contract together first before the ventricles do. So first atria followed by both ventricles. All right. Sometimes there can be fibrillation in the heart. The atria can fibrillate, which means then that an action potential will not just move nice and linear from the sinoatrial node origin, but can actually wander around on the surface of the atria. And as that signal is wandering around, it's going to cause that little ribbon of muscle cells to contract. So the atria don't contract as a unit. They just kind of sit there and wiggle around a little bit. They quiver. In order to pump blood, a chamber has to contract in unison. All right, so the atria in those circumstances aren't pumping blood. Blood is going to stay in these atria. Some will flow into the ventricles, of course. That's usually not a big problem because look how weak these atria are anyway. Right, so if the atria lose contractile properties, that's not such a big deal for the heart, but that is for blood. Guess what happens to blood when it sits stationary? It likes to clot. Right, so atrial fibrillation is really dangerous, not because it reduces heart function, but because it forms blood clots, right, which then go into a ventricle and then to the lungs, causing pulmonary embolism, or goes into the left ventricle, produces heart attack or stroke. Right, and a lot of times we can convert, right, that electrical signal back to a normal sinus rhythm, get rid of atrial fibrillation. Sometimes that can't happen. So if we can't convert somebody's atrial contraction back to normal, then what do we have to do for somebody if blood is being stagnated in the atria? You got to reduce clotting function somehow, right? With Coumarin or something like that. Of course, there's side effects, right? Okay. All right. Then the ventricles contract. Excitation, contraction, coupling. We talked about this before, previous chapter. Okay, depolarization of the contractile cells when voltage-gated calcium channels open. Depolarization opens voltage-gated and calcium-induced calcium release channels, just like in skeletal muscle. And just like in skeletal muscle, calcium binds to troponin that gets tropomyosin out of the way so that the myosin head groups can bind onto the G-actin binding site. And, of course, there's ATP in the heart, so you're going to have cross-bridge cycling and sliding of myofilaments over each other. And in order for the heart to relax, then calcium is pumped back out of the cell or back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and that causes relaxation of all those sarcomeres. All right, this slide right here just shows you the extended refractory period. All right, so I see an action potential. I'm tracing an action potential right here. Right, and I also see contraction, force of contraction on this other line. But if I look at this action potential, you should be able to tell me what kind of cell is that coming from. Does that look like a neuron? No. Does it look like a nodal cell? No. It looks like a contractile cell because I see this plateau region. And what produces this plateau region? Yeah, those calcium channels, right, that are slow to close. All right, so here we see the absolute refractory period. So during this period of time, this muscle cell can't be triggered into contracting once again. Here is still a relative refractory period. And as a matter of fact, you know, maybe I kind of disagree with this diagram. I would say the absolute refractory period probably comes down over to here. And so that just prevents the heart from cramping up or going into tetany, which is a good thing, right? Because that would be like immediately fatal if that were to happen. All right, let's superimpose the electrocardiogram with the extrapotential from a contractile cell. Most of the cells, well, by far, most of the cells in your heart are contractile cells, not nodal cells. So by far, most of the cells have a plateau region right here. And so the waves that we see on an ECG, ECG is just a measure of all the electrical activity taking place in your body that we can measure on your surface. And one of the things that makes most of the electrical activity is your heart, unless you're using skeletal muscles. But when you're getting an ECG, you're supposed to not contract other skeletal muscles. I see a number of waves. I see the primavera wave. That's the first one. We're just going to call that the P. And then a couple more, QRS. And then at a later time, T. So P represents depolarization of the atria. And what's going to follow depolarization of the atria? Contraction. At a short period of time after, contraction of the atria are going to take place. They force a little blood into the ventricles. And then here is the QRS signal. And that is due to what? That rapid depolarization due to within the contractile cells of the heart. And so you got millions and millions of all these cells adding up together to produce this QRS complex, which is measurable on the surface of your body. Right. After depolarization, does repolarization take place immediately? No, not for most of the cells. There's that plateau phase. Repolarization takes place, and that's what the T wave is. QRS is depolarization of the ventricles. The T wave is repolarization of the ventricles, and you can take a look at it right here on this action potential. Right? And there has to be repolarization before depolarization can take place again. All right. So here I see depolarization of the atria. Where's repolarization of the atria? Because it's got to repolarize, otherwise it can't depolarize again. It happens within the QRS complex, and since there are very, very few atrial cells, we can't really see that signal. You have many, many more cells in the ventricles, and the depolarization from the ventricles just outweighs everything, any kind of signal that comes from the atria. Right. So one way to think of that is if we go outside right now, let's pretend there's no clouds out there, and we look up in the sky, can we see any stars up there? Can we see stars? Sun's a star, but let's forget about the sun. Right? You can't see stars. Right? But are there stars there? There are stars there. You just can't see them because the sun is so bright. Right? So that's what's happening with this QRS complex. It represents depolarization of the ventricles and also repolarization of the atria, but we can't see repolarization of the atria, even though we know it's right in there. All right, so that's ECG, electrocardiogram. Sometimes it's spelled in an old German kind of way with a K for cardio. And in a hospital, you might find one hallway with ECG and another hallway with EKG. And it means what? Exactly the same thing. Okay, electrocardiogram. All right, so these are the three distinct waves. Remember, the ECG waveforms are not a measure of contraction. They are strictly excitatory events, signals for contraction. Okay, what kind of machine? What do you call a machine that acquires and records an ECG? Electrocardiograph. And what do you call the thing that it puts out, that piece of paper? That's an electrocardiogram. All right, which events occur first in the heart? Mechanical, like contraction, or electrical events? Electrical events first. Remember, excitation-contraction coupling. Excitation comes first before contraction, and that excitation is an electrical event, right? Action potential moving over the cell surface. And myocardial cells have T-tubules as well, so that action potentials can move deep inside the myocardial cells. Okay, here's a really good diagram for you guys. All right, so first we see depolarization of the SA node, and then we're going to move down, and I see that depolarization moves everywhere through the atria because there's all these cells have gap junctions, right? So an action potential will flow from one cell to the next. So both atria are completely depolarized. That's going to cause contraction of the atria that produces the P wave. Right? And then the atria repolarize. We see what part of the ventricles depolarize first? apical regions, right? Because of the bundle branches, the signal moves down very, very rapidly, then into Purkinje fibers down here by the apex, and then it moves up the free wall of the ventricles, excites more Purkinje fibers, right? Then the basilar regions of the heart contract, and then the apical regions start to repolarize, and that produces the T wave, right? So depolarization of the ventricles is the QRS complex. But what else is happening during depolarization of the ventricles? If we look up here, hopefully it's color-coded for you guys. What's happening to the atria when the ventricles depolarize? They repolarize, but we can't see that signal because depolarization of the ventricles is so large. Okay, so here is a correlation of ECG. Right, here is the electrocardiogram with heart sounds and also contraction. So this first graph right here is pressure. That's a pretty good indication of myocardial contraction. Pressure won't increase unless the muscle is contracting. All right, so here's the QRS complex. It starts right here. Right, what about contraction of the ventricle? Does it start right here? It does not. It's delayed a little bit, right? And so that's the excitation part, then it starts to contract. So this is pressure in a ventricle, and when this pressure reaches 80 millimeters of mercury, let's just say that that's the diastolic pressure in the aorta. So now you have higher pressure, okay? You have higher pressure in the ventricle compared to the atria. So if you have high pressure in a ventricle compared to the atria, blood is going to flow back into the atria, but what prevents that from happening? Closing of the AV valves. Okay, then blood is ejected from the ventricle into the aorta. Right at about this time right here, right, then the pressure in the aorta is greater than the ventricle, but blood can't go from aorta back into the ventricle if it's a normal heart. What happens? The semilunar valve closes, producing the second heart sound. So first heart sound, closing of the AV valves. Second heart sound, closing of the semilunar valves. All right, who knows what I'm talking about when I say semilunar valve? Everybody familiar with a semilunar valve? How many do you have? How many semilunar valves do you have? Four? Three? You got two. Yeah, you've got an aortic semilunar valve and a pulmonary semilunar valve. How many atrial ventricular valves do we have? Two, one between the right atria and right ventricle, and one between the left atrium and left ventricle. All right, so you got two kinds of valves. And they close passively just due to pressure differences across the valve. There's no muscle in valves. All right, structures of blood vessels. I think you're pretty much familiar with all this stuff from anatomy. Okay, maybe we'll go through these questions real quick. Material can enter or leave the blood only through a particular vessel. The name of that vessel is a capillary, right? Because capillaries are thin. Arteries and veins are way too thick to allow for diffusion. So anything that's in the blood is stuck in the blood, can't go anywhere until that blood gets into a capillary. What structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? We're going to talk about that. It's called a precapillary sphincter. Maybe that rings a bell from anatomy, maybe not. Name two mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. Right. How does fluid flow once again? From high pressure to low pressure. Pressure in veins is very, very low. The pressure in the heart is very low. So how does blood flow from a vein back to the heart if the pressures are very, very low? And we're going to see how that is. There are two mechanisms that allow that. They're called the respiratory pump and muscle pump, skeletal muscle pump. Name three types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. And when I say cardiovascular structure, we can consider the lymphatic vessels as well. So what kind of structure has a valve that you know of, or a couple valves? Yeah, the heart has valves. What else has valves? Veins have valves. That's two. And then one more thing, lymphatic vessels have valves as well. Okay, so those are the three structures. Okay, what layer in the heart is responsible for forming valves? And it's the same layer that's in the veins and lymphatic vessels. What are the three layers of the heart? On the surface is the epicardium. The thick middle part is called myocardium. And what's the inner lining called? Endocardium. All right, so which one of those layers forms a valve? It is the endocardium. That's a thin layer. It's very smooth and slippery so that blood can slide over it without generating blood clots. And valves are made out of endocardium. And remember, endocardium is not contractile. It's just a membrane. So those valves are not muscles. They just open and close depending on the pressure difference across them. What's the difference between a sphincter and a valve? That's sort of interesting. A sphincter is a smooth muscle. When it contracts, it closes, right? So a sphincter requires energy. It's a muscle, requires ATP. But a valve right here is just passive, right? Doesn't require any ATP. So that is what I was trying to get at there. All right, structure of blood vessels. You guys should know all that. Now, here's something that's interesting, which we didn't really learn in anatomy. All right, so here is, or here are the various kinds of blood vessels in our body. Here is an artery, right? And it's colored red. So what circulation does this artery belong to? Systemic, right? So you got systemic and pulmonary. This red signifies relatively high oxygen. That's what that color stands for, right? So a systemic artery is going to be relatively high in oxygen. What about a pulmonary artery? Relatively low in oxygen. It's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. What's the definition of an artery? Is it due to the substance that it's carrying, like oxygen? Well, you just told me that systemic is going to be high in oxygen, pulmonary artery is going to be low in oxygen, so an artery doesn't have to have high or low oxygen. It could be either depending on what circulation it belongs to. So the definition of an artery is just the direction of blood flow. So in this particular case that I see right here, where is the heart? Is it above the diagram or below the diagram? Blood flow is this direction, so the heart is above. Right? So the definition of an artery is that it takes blood away from the heart. That's the whole deal. Doesn't matter if it's a blue artery or a red artery. Red systemic, blue pulmonary. All right, then you got a tiny artery called an arteriole. These are microscopic, and these are going to lead to a capillary. Here is a capillary network, right? These capillaries are special. They only have endothelium, which is really, really thin. There are different kinds of capillaries. Some are more leaky than others, depending on the nature of holes within the endothelium. Some are fenestrated, some are sinusoidal, some are continuous. Probably the next slide will show that to you if you're not familiar with it. But here is something that I want to point out. You don't have enough blood in your body to go through every capillary bed, right? If all these capillary beds were being perfused with blood, our blood pressure would drop, we'd pass out. So our body has to determine where blood is going to go to. And part of what determines that are these pre-capillary sphincters. What is a sphincter once again? It's a muscle that requires energy to contract, and when it contracts, it closes something off. Right? It could be maybe the lumen of the digestive tract. In this particular case, it's the lumen of a blood vessel entering a capillary. Here's the precapillary sphincter. When it's contracted, blood in this arteriole passes straight through to the vein without going through the capillary. All right, so this little thing right here, we call this an arteriovenosus shunt. Blood just shunts back and doesn't go into this capillary. Right, but when the precapillary sphincter relaxes and dilates, then blood flows to the capillary. This precapillary sphincter does not receive any nerve input. It's regulated by other things. Right, so it's not regulated by the parasympathetic nervous system or sympathetic nervous system. It's regulated by the metabolism of these cells that are around the capillary. And that's a really important concept. Your book doesn't talk about it in this particular chapter, so let's write that down. Precapillary sphincter. Okay, so here we have Here we have a capillary network. And what regulates blood into this network right here? A sphincter. All right, so here we have arteriole. Here we have capillary. And here we have venule. All right, so and then here's that precapillary sphincter. You say it's regulated by the metabolism of these cells. Let's just say these are muscle cells in this area, and they're contracting. What could you tell me about ATP in a contracting muscle? It's probably going down, right? And as ATP goes down, what's a chemical that builds up? What's a breakdown product of ATP? ADP, right? So when the muscle is, let's go under exercise. Exercise, you have increased ADP. Okay, when that muscle is contracting, oxygen can't get to it. All right, so what's going to help replenish ATP when the muscle doesn't have oxygen? What kind of metabolism is taking place? Anaerobic metabolism. What is one of the last compounds produced by anaerobic metabolism? Something that keeps glycolysis open and running. Lactic acid. Remember lactic acid? So during exercise, you're going to have increased lactic acid. Okay, if there's increased lactic acid, what happens to pH? It goes down. Decreased pH in exercise. All right, what about CO2? Increases. What about oxygen? Decreases. Okay, so this muscle, right, needs what? Oxygen. Needs to get rid of CO2. Needs to restore pH by getting rid of lactic acid. Right, and we want to rebuild this ADP, and we need oxygen to do that. So under these conditions, what do you think should happen to this precapillary sphincter? Should it relax and dilate, or should it contract? Okay, when all these things are present, that causes relaxation. Of that precapillary sphincter. When it dilates, blood flow can enter, and all these things go back to normal, maintaining homeostasis. Down over here, let's just say normal ATP, high oxygen, okay, normal pH, no lactic acid. All right, so when these things go back to normal, guess what happens to that precapillary sphincter? Okay, it contracts. All right, so that's what's happening right there, but you got to know what that mechanism is called. That is an intrinsic property of that muscle. It's not extrinsic. Extrinsic means that the regulation is coming from central nervous system or from some other place, some exterior place. All right, this is intrinsic regulation just to what's happening right here. Let me put that right in this box right here. Okay. Intrinsic control, just within the muscle, and we call that in particular local control. Local control, right, is just something that happens depending on the metabolism of these cells. The more active they get, the more this precapillary sphincter dilates. The less active they are, the more the precapillary sphincter contracts. That is local control. Okay. Can you kind of follow that pretty well? I think it sort of makes sense. All right, so we covered all this. Here are different kinds of capillaries, right? The three major kinds, continuous, fenestrated, sinusoidal. All your book calls sinusoidal, discontinuous capillaries. They're the most leaky, like in the liver. That's a really good example. Most are continuous. Fenestrated ones, like in the glomerulus, they're kind of leaky, but not too bad. All right, veins. Contain the majority of blood in your circulatory system because they can dilate a lot without very much change in pressure. All right, so let's think of a balloon and your car tire. Which one is more compliant? All right, if you want to blow up a balloon, okay, you can blow it up just by yourself blowing into it, right? You can increase the pressure a little bit. What happens to the balloon? It expands a lot. Can you force air into your tire just by blowing into it? No, because the tire is just way too rigid, too tough. So the balloon is compliant, but your car tire is not. Vanes are much more like a balloon. Small changes in pressure then cause large changes in volume, just like a balloon. Right. Vanes have very low pressure, about 2 millimeters of mercury. What was it in a systemic artery? 120 over 80, right? There's a huge difference. And remember, that pressure difference between the heart and these blood vessels determines the amount of flow. The pressure in the heart is about zero. So there's only 2 millimeters of mercury pressure that's forcing blood from veins back to the heart. That's not enough pressure to get blood back to the heart. So how does blood get back to the heart? Here's one of the mechanisms that I see. All right, so here is a vein, nicely colored blue. So I think this is a nice, systemic vein. And this vein is going between a couple muscles. And how do I know this is a vein if I look at it? Valves. That's right. Arteries don't have any valves. Only veins have valves and lymphatics, but we don't have a lymphatic vessel right here. All right, so what does that mean? Which way can blood flow? Only these valves can open this way and that way, and blood can flow from this chamber up to the one above it. If it tries to flow backwards, then the valve closes and it can't. All right? All right, so this is the skeletal muscle pump. You have this vein going between these two muscles. When they contract, they bulge, right, just like any muscle, and it compresses this segment of the vein. And when it compresses, the pressure in this segment of the vein increases, right, and so it's going to want to squirt toward the heart. It's also going to want to squirt back down to the periphery, but can it go back down into the periphery? In this case, it doesn't, because you have a nice competent valve right here. All right, if something has happened to this vein to where it has dilated and these leaflets here can't approximate or touch each other, they're just going to flop back and forth. And in that particular case, blood is going to go a little bit to the heart, a little back down into the periphery. That's what we call a varicose vein or varicose valve. That's not very good. All right, so if this is a nice competent valve, whenever a muscle contracts, pressurizes this little segment right here, blood squirts toward the heart. So the skeletal muscle pump is really important for moving blood back to the heart. All right, the other one is what we call the respiratory pump. And the air that we breathe is a fluid. So the air that we breathe moves in and out of our body according to what? What's making it move? Pressure, right? Just like any other kind of fluid. So if air is going to flow into our lungs, right, where is the pressure high? In the air or in our lungs? If air is flowing in, where is pressure going to be high? In the air, and it's going to be low in the lungs, right? And you do that by expanding the thoracic cavity. When we get into respiratory system, you'll see how that goes. So if we expand the thoracic cavity, decrease the pressure in our thorax, air is going to flow in, because you've created like a vacuum cleaner, air is going to flow in. But if the pressure in your thorax is decreased, not only will air flow in, but any other kind of fluid like venous blood. So venous blood will get sucked up into your thorax from various peripheral parts of your body. That's what we call the respiratory pump. Then when we compress our thorax and increase the pressure so that air can flow out, does blood in the thorax flow back down to the periphery when we pressurize? I mean, air leaves when we pressurize our chest, but does blood get pushed back down to the periphery? And you should see from this diagram, it doesn't, because veins have valves, right? So when you're breathing, that helps return blood to the heart. When you're exercising skeletal muscle, that helps return blood to the heart, as long as what? These valves are healthy, right? And that can be superficial valves that don't work, like varicose veins, or it could be valves deep inside some body compartment, as we call deep veins. And remember, what happens to blood when it stops moving, when it becomes stationary, forms a blood clot. All right, so these kinds of valves that don't work properly are really dangerous, right? Deep vein thrombosis is very easy to be fatal, okay? And it's really hard to deal with because you can't surgically repair these valves. All right, so that's how blood gets back. The respiratory pump or the skeletal muscle pump, increasing pressure in just one segment, and because of the valves, it can only go in one direction. All right, so that's it for the test. Okay, so there was some anatomy right there. Sinus sheet is going around. What do we call this control? Where the metabolites or metabolism, okay, in this area controls whether this precapillary sphincter is dilated or contracted. That is local control. You could say intrinsic control. Local control might be a little bit better. All right, and in this particular case, there is another important point. How many circulations are there in the body? There are two. And guess what? This local control works like this, only for systemic circulation. What's the other circulation? The pulmonary circulation. Doesn't work like that for pulmonary circulation. So when we get into the next chapter, I'll talk about that a little bit. Okay. Okay, so what kind of questions do we have? The Wiggers diagram, study guide is all that's important. Okay. Do you know how to calculate stroke volume? Might have to bring a calculator. Maybe you should bring a calculator. Okay. Yeah, like on that Wiggers diagram?
Yeah,
okay. Let's do it. I think I found some okay YouTubes on this. I don't know if I really like any in particular, but you could check it out. As a matter of fact, I don't like them so much that I would actually put a link in Blackboard. All right, so here it is. This is like a really classical kind of illustration. And so we're going to plot out something versus time. Right, so the horizontal axis in time, and all of these graphs up here are justified in time so that if you know something's happening down here on this line, it's at the exact same time as the one above it, one above it, one above it. So what are the four things that we're looking at? All right, we see pressure versus time. That's one. We see volume versus time. We see electrical events versus time. And then we see sound events versus time. Right, so the pressure, we see aortic pressure, we see pressure in an atria, we see pressure in a ventricle. So I see three traces right here. The volume is just ventricular volume, and this trace of electrical activity, we call that electrocardiogram. And then the sound events right here, when recorded, we call that a phonocardiogram due to the sound. All right, so how does fluid flow once again? High pressure to low pressure. Here I see pressure in an atria, I see pressure in a ventricle. Which way is blood going to flow? From atria to ventricle because pressure is higher in the atria. So the ventricle is going to fill up under these conditions, and if we look at the volume curve, do we see that the volume of the ventricle increase during this period of time? Yeah, because it's flowing from atria into a ventricle. All right. When the pressure inside the ventricle, right, gets to be greater than that of the atria, blood is going to want to flow from ventricle back into the atrium, but can it in a normal heart? No. The AV valve closes. Right? And when the AV valve closes, what does that produce? First heart sound. All right. So the semilunar valves are closed, so the AV valve, semilunar valves are closed. If all the doors to the ventricle are closed, blood can either enter or leave. It's got to stay the same volume, so we call that isovolumetric. And here is that ECG starting over here. At a later time, the ventricle starts to contract, so this is isovolumetric contraction as a result. All right, as the ventricular pressure exceeds the aortic pressure, right, then the semilunar valve is going to open. Right? It's just due to pressure. There's no muscle opening or closing it. Right? And when the aortic valve opens, blood is going to flow from the ventricle into the aorta, increasing the pressure of the aorta. But what's going to happen to the volume of the ventricle? It's going to start to decrease because it's being ejected from the ventricle. Right? And then, right, let's move this curve over to here. That's probably a little bit better. Say at this point in time now, the pressure in the ventricle is less than the aorta. Blood should not go from aorta back into the ventricle. What's going to happen? Closing of the aortic semilunar valve at that point in time. And what does that produce? Second heart sound. Okay. And now all the doors to that ventricle are closed, right? And what do we have? Isovolumetric relaxation. And then when the pressure in the ventricles goes below the atria, blood can flow from the atria into the ventricle. And as blood flows from atria to ventricle, what happens to the volume of the ventricle? It starts to increase, right? Now the atria aren't even contracting at this point. Blood is just flowing right straight through it. Okay, just filling up the ventricles. The atria don't contract until right after the P wave, right? And so this little bump right here in ventricular volume is a result of contraction of the atria. So this increase in volume is not nearly as important as this increase in volume just to passive filling of the heart. All right, so what do we see? Well, when we have pressure in the aorta closing the aortic semilunar valve, that decreases the pressure in the aorta transiently, just a little bit. That causes this little dip in the aortic pressure curve that's called a dicrotic notch. That's normal, that belongs there. When you see that dicrotic notch, then you know the aortic semilunar valve is closing, right? And I can see it right here. All right. The other thing that I notice, if we look at the aorta, right, what kind of circulation does it belong to? Systemic or pulmonary? Aorta is systemic circulation, and what kind of normal pressures would we expect in the systemic circulation? Like 120 for systole, 80 for diastole, and guess what? Here's your answer key, because here I see 120 for systolic pressure. Here is the lowest pressure, and that is 80, right? So it's 120 over 80 in this nice aorta right here. That's not going to be the case for pulmonary. That's going to be way down over here someplace. All right, so after all of this blood is ejected from the ventricle into the aorta, notice that the pressure decreases, but not rapidly. It slowly decreases to 80 until, right, the ECG triggers another heartbeat, and then it bumps back up to 180. So you have two phases of the cardiac cycle. You have one phase when the heart is contracting, and another phase when the heart is relaxed. The contracted form is what we call systole, that's followed by relaxation, that is diastole. You see diastole is a little bit longer than systole. Systole is pretty short. Okay, QRS precedes contraction of the ventricles. P wave precedes contraction of the atria that we see right here, right? Because that's just excitation, that's not necessarily contraction. And you can see why these heart sounds occur at these particular locations. All right, the only other thing that maybe I would say right here is that we can determine the stroke volume of this particular heart. How do we determine stroke volume? Volume, you look at the volume of the ventricle, find where the end diastolic volume is. Okay, so here is diastole. Oh, let's look here. Here's diastole. Where's the end of diastole? Right here. That is end diastolic volume. Where's systole? Here's systole. Here is end systole. So here's the end systolic volume. And what do you subtract from each other? You subtract end systolic volume from end diastolic volume to get what the stroke volume is. And somebody should tell me, what is stroke volume? The amount of blood that's pumped by the heart every time it beats, right? And what's a good unit? How do you measure that? What's a good unit for volume? Milliliters. Yeah, milliliters. You could measure it anything you want, quarts, pints, or whatever, but here it is in milliliters. That's a volume, right? That's just a volume. Okay, question.
Did you say for isovolumetric contraction?
Right here. All the valves are closed. All the valves are closed during isovolumetric periods. Whether they're contraction or relaxation doesn't matter. When all the doors are closed, all the windows are closed, the volume can't change. Nothing can get in, can get out. So the volume of that ventricle doesn't change. Okay, but that doesn't mean the pressure can't change, right? You can close your fist, and the volume of your fist doesn't change, and then you can squeeze harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. The pressure's increasing, but the size of your fist isn't changing, right? Okay, but nonetheless, that the force is being imparted to the blood, so when valves open, it gets ejected out. All right, how about another question regarding this Wigger's diagram? Yeah. Okay, here is the end diastole. Yeah. Yep. And it repeats because the QRS is driving that. Here's the depolarization of the ventricles. That's going to cause contraction of the ventricles, which we see follows the QRS complex just slightly in time. Okay. I think I saw another question. Is there another question over here? No? Yeah, here's one. P-wave. Okay, P-wave is excitatory. It is depolarization of the atria. Let's go over that. So we got P, Q, R, S, T. So that's how you would like to think of the whole cardiac cycle, starting with the P-wave. P-wave is atrial depolarization. That's a signal for contraction, right? That's an excitatory event. And then those cells are going to repolarize at a much later time because of that plateau phase. It happens at the exact same time that the ventricles depolarize, right? And that's called the QRS complex due to two things: depolarization of ventricles, repolarization of atria. Right? Then the ventricular contractile cells have that long plateau phase. They don't repolarize until a later time. And that's what we measure as the T wave. So T wave is just repolarization of the ventricles. It has nothing to do with atria. Right? And then everything goes back to resting membrane potential. Remember, those HCN channels open up, start to depolarize the nodal tissue in the SA node, reaches threshold, and then you get this P wave once again. Okay? And that SA node is autorhythmic. But the rate that it reaches threshold is coordinated by both the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, okay? The SA node. So if you take somebody's heart out, put it on a table, it will beat. But if you want to regulate it, then it's best to have parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, right? Gas pedal and brake pedal working on it. All right, so what kind of neurotransmitter would decrease heart rate? If we just took some neurotransmitter and a little dropper and put a little drop of that neurotransmitter on the heart, what would decrease its rate? It would be due to stimulating muscarinic receptors, so it's got to be acetylcholine from the parasympathetic nervous system, right? So parasympathetic nervous system slows the heart rate down. What neurotransmitter increases heart rate? Would be norepinephrine or epinephrine, adrenaline or noradrenaline, right? It's going to bind to receptors. Ooh, what kind of receptors are in the heart? What kind of adrenergic receptors, right, in particular? Two major kinds, right? You got alpha and beta. Of the major kinds, which one is it? It's beta, yeah. And then what subclass of beta? Beta 1. Right, and that's excitatory. Beta 2 are inhibitory for bronchioles, for instance. All right, that kind of is a nice concept map for that. Does that sort of answer your question? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Please don't forget your picture ID, and you're all in three different classes, right? And so for me to get your grades online fast, I don't want to have all the classes mixed because it's going to be hard to find you in Blackboard. I'm going to have Tuesday on pile here, Thursday afternoon here, and Thursday evening here. Put your Scantron in the right pile, and then I'll be able to get your grades in Blackboard same day. Okay?